the really big, huge, continuous mistake that I seem to make over and over again in my marriage is to take so that I'll be happy or so that I'll feel good. Unfortunately, what that creates in my marriage is distance, and what it creates in me is selfishness. What I've had to learn over years is the irony that out of death comes life.
Welcome again to Christianity at Work, the radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. Today, Dr. Jack Crabtree and professional therapist Christine Barber explore the question, what makes a good marriage? We all want a good marriage, but is it possible that striving to be happy in marriage might be wrong? Isn't marriage supposed to make us happy? Or did God create marriage for a much more important purpose? Let's hear what Jack and Christine have to say about having a good marriage.
You know, Jack, I was thinking that it's a good thing that people can't see us, so this is simply on the radio, because I was just out collecting dog poops out of the yard, and I spilled coffee all over me before we started.
And I haven't shaved.
You haven't shaved. That's right, I noticed you hadn't shaved. And I was even going to be fancy enough to wear my rubber-soled slippers, but they got so wet when I was picking up the dog poops that now I only have on my socks. When you arrived this morning on your motorcycle, you look like a Harley Davidson guy. Or is that the way to say it?
A Hell's Angel.
Hell's Angel guy. So we're kind of a sight to see. This morning we're going to talk about what are the components of a good marriage. What can people realistically hope for in a good marriage? Many people say, Jack, that God invented marriage to be a picture of Christ in the church. Jack, I wonder if you could start us off today by exploring that idea.
Okay. It's understandable that people might have that understanding, or that they might come to that conclusion, because you have, in Ephesians 5, you have Paul drawing an analogy between the love that Christ has for the church and the kind of love that a husband should have for his wife. You know, he says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church, and goes on to talk about how Christ loved the church enough to die for it, basically, and is saying that's the kind of love you husbands need to have for your wives. But because he draws that analogy, people have concluded that that's the purpose of marriage, that the purpose of marriage is to create this object lesson or picture for God to use to teach us about Christ's relationship to the church. I think that ultimately trivializes marriage. I mean, to suggest that God's purpose for it is just so that he can have an analogy that he can make later, a pedagogical tool to teach us who Christ is in relationship to the church, kind of detracts from the actual substantially good thing that marriage is in and of itself in its own right. I think it just makes more sense to realize that God created this wonderful, rewarding relationship called marriage that he made a part of his creation. And Paul, in observing that, recognized that there is an important analogy between the relationship between a husband who's operating as a husband ought to and his wife and Christ's relationship to the church. The kind of love that is required of a husband in marriage is like the kind of love that Jesus actually gave to us who are his church. Paul just observed that parallel, that analogy, and exploited it to help us understand, we who are husbands, to understand how we ought to behave. God's creation is full of wonderful things, delightful, joy-filled, rewarding things. Marriage is one of them. And if we really want to understand marriage, I think we just have to understand why it's rewarding on its own terms. The point being, it's not there to give Paul a picture to use. It's there because it's meaningful to you and me and rewarding to the human psyche that God has created in us.
So, Jack, honestly, I'm not sure that I'm following you really well.
Okay.
Let's make sure that I'm getting it. You're saying, though, although marriage is a picture of Christ in the church, that's not really the substance of what marriage is about.
Well, in the sense that that's not why God created it. That's what I'm objecting to, is the notion that we can really understand why God gave us marriage by understanding that God wanted to create a kind of picture of Christ relationship of the church that otherwise would be invisible to us or something like that. That's the suggestion that kind of gets made by some people. And then they carry that out. Let's take an example. The argument would go, God created marriage to be a picture of Christ in the church. What's wrong with adultery? What's wrong with adultery is it's wrong for the church to be unfaithful to their Lord. Therefore, it's wrong for a husband to be unfaithful to their wife. Frankly, I think that's ultimately nonsense. What's wrong with adultery is it would be cruel and a cruel betrayal of my wife to be unfaithful to her. That's what's wrong with it. Not that I'm wrecking the metaphor, not that I'm wrecking the picture, and otherwise it would be okay. It's wrong because God created marriage to be a very rewarding relationship for a man and a woman, and when I commit adultery, I wreck it. I turn what ought to be rewarding into a relationship of agonizing pain for somebody. That's what's wrong with it.
Well, let's look at marriage and understand what is good about it. One of the reasons that you and I wanted to talk about this subject is because you and I both have, in our own lives, a very rewarding relationship with our spouses. I know for me that my marriage is probably the best thing that I have here on earth. That it's the greatest gift, it's the most rewarding thing that I experience. What does make our marriage as rewarding is the question that we want to address today.
I can go a certain distance in answering that theoretically. I think you'll be in a better position to answer that at a more concrete level. So I'll throw that back to you. But in theoretical terms, I have to believe that God has simply created my psyche to need and to be satisfied when I get from somebody a relationship where I am truly appreciated, truly respected, truly where my existence is truly acknowledged in a meaningful way. To be significant to somebody, to be significant to somebody important to me, is the ultimate reward of marriage, I think. I am not nothing. I am not a worthless and valueless human being if somebody that's important to me values me highly. And the experience of being valued in that way, I think, ultimately is the reward of marriage.
Let's stop there just for a moment and come back to what is significant about being married.
Jack and Christine will be back in just a few moments. Here's something about Jack Crabtree. Years ago, he began to seriously study the Book of Romans. So what, you say? Lots of people study the Book of Romans. Well, the more Jack studied, the more he began to see a difference between what he had always believed Christianity to be all about and what the Book of Romans was telling him. The difference bothered him, and he had to get to the bottom of it. What emerged was a fresh and insightful understanding of the gospel, an understanding that changed his life. Over the years, Jack has taught on the Book of Romans, other books of the Bible, and numerous topics. In each case, he brings his desire to get to the bottom of it. He believes that it's worth our while to seek out truth, even if it's hard work. Christine Barber is a professional marriage and family therapist. Because she works closely with people who are suffering and struggling through life's toughest problems, she has to be committed to truth. This means being committed to her clients' best interest, to their growth as wise people, and to see real change in people's lives being the work of God. For her, the answers to life's big questions are rooted in the truth of God's Word. She sees this world as the arena where God grows us up into wise people who love the things of God and look forward to His kingdom. Now, here again are Jack and Christine.
Jack, before our break, we started talking about what makes marriage really good for us. And you were saying that what makes your relationship especially good, or at least one of the things, is that you really have a place in another person's life. You're not nothing. You're not invisible. You're a person that to another person has substance and worth and value.
Yes, exactly. It's not the cure-all. I know that ultimately we need to find our significance and our value in the love of God and in the purposes of God, that's really the only thing that's going to finally satisfy us. But what reward that there is in marriage comes from the fact that another human being values me.
I like the way you said that. I like that you said that first, because I think ultimately that really is the best thing about marriage. For me too, that I'm a person who has importance to my husband. I don't feel like I'm alone in this world. And I think that's one of the biggest problems that people experience, is a tremendous sense of aloneness and unimportance to anybody else in the world. So being connected with one person that says, through all their actions, through all their words, that I am important, I am valued by them, really gives me a sense of well-being in this world.
Mm-hmm.
But Jack, as we're talking about valuing another person, I think we need to break that down, because it's easy on one hand to say, I'm valued by and important to another person, but how do we show that? Another way of saying that I'm valued is that I'm being loved by another person, because mm-hmm. in loving a person, I am valuing them. Could we spend some time here talking about what valuing is, what it really looks like, or correspondingly, what love looks like?
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to turn that question back on you, because maybe you're in a better position to answer that. But before you do, let me. It's commonplace, I think, for us to think that the essence of the marriage relationship is love, and that's certainly true, as long as we have the right conception of love. And I think that's crucial to understand, because we have such a mythology about love being a kind of romantic connection with another person. And that's the question I want to ask you, is what is this love that really is at the heart and essence of what marriage is all about? My suspicion is that you're not going to give me romance as the essence of that. What is it then?
Okay.
What is it that when a husband loves a wife, or a wife loves a husband in the way that God, I think, intended in marriage, what are they going to do?
Okay, I'd like, though, to put a bookmark on the whole area of romance. I think that to really understand love, we must understand the difference between love and romance, or love and, quote, falling in love with another person. So at a future time, let's talk about that. But what is love? Right. You know, I've been reading a book over again that I've read a number of times by Scott Peck. It's called The Road Less Traveled. I'm sure that many people who are listening have read that book. But he has a whole section on love. And let me just throw out his definition. And let's kind of look at it and see what we think about it. It is the will to extend oneself for the purpose of nurturing one's own or another's spiritual growth.
Repeat that again.
The will to extend oneself for the purpose of nurturing one's own or another's spiritual growth.
Okay. What do you understand him to mean by extend oneself?
Well, he goes in and talks a lot about all these concepts, so I'm not going to try and explain Scott Peck's book here. I would encourage people to read it if they're interested. But he's saying that it's an act of courage.
Okay.
That I courageously look at and understand another person beyond just my own limits. That I don't just become a person who is dependent on another person making me feel good, but I'm a person who, out of my own courage, out of my own risk, becomes a person who's larger. Extending myself requires that I allow my husband to be a separate person, that I don't try to make him who I want him only to be. I let him have his own separate identity, his own separate interests, his own separate person, in whatever shape that might take. On one hand, I think we can say, well, of course, that's true. That's obvious. But I don't think that's obvious at all. I don't think that's easy at all to do. Because when I am extending myself to allow him to be his own separate person, then it creates an anxiety in me. The anxiety in me that I am different. And what if in our differences, for example, he doesn't like me? What if I am encouraging him to look at what he's interested in and he goes his own direction? It's difficult for me. It creates anxiety in me to allow that to occur.
It seems to me that I hear not infrequently a plea for help from women more than I hear this from men, where they're talking about I've lost myself, or I've had to what's the language? I've had to
give myself up,
that kind of thing. Can you shed some light on that? As a male, I've always had a little bit of trouble with that, just because I wouldn't use that language about myself. And maybe you have some perspective on what is happening there. What happens that they have this sense of losing themselves? Are their husbands putting subtle pressure on them to be something that the husband wants them to be, or not so subtle pressure on them? Is it the husband's fault? Is it a occupational hazard of being a mother? Do you have any insight into what's happening there?
I certainly don't think we can put the fault on one person or the other. I think that we both, as the husband and the wife, need to take responsibility for either one, quote, losing themselves or having to give up themselves. I think that I'm trying to think of an example where that occurs, and it certainly occurs a lot. I think for many women, out of fear of being rejected, out of fear of not being liked, give up their thinking about what they value, what's important to them, what they need, what they feel, what gives meaning to life, and instead, out of that fear or out of laziness, they become what they think their husband wants them to be. And what that does is, in their mind, secure a place in the relationship with their husband. And for many husbands, it is a security, because they don't have to, as I said before, have to face into any kind of anxiety about someone being different than themselves. They get to have the security that I'm okay because somebody else wants to go my way, because they like who I am, and that doesn't challenge me. It doesn't really take courage to have to go the way I've always gone, and if my wife goes along with me, then I feel comfortable. And I think a lot of marriage, I think wrongly, but a lot of marriage is about feeling comfortable and not challenging each other to growth. And I think that's a huge part of what God set up marriage to be, is to challenge us to grow up and to mature and to become wise people. But so we have this configuration where the wife is afraid of becoming her own person, thinking her own way, and the husband feels very comfortable with that. He might also, in very subtle or very strong ways, exert a lot of pressure on the wife to become what he wants her to be. It could be through anger, demandingness. Well, it's always through demandingness in some way. The demandingness could be just through subtle manipulation, through guilt, through withholding things that she might want, like attention or talking to or listening to or being a part of her life, unless she goes along with what he wants her to be.
So is it possible for a husband to be attracted to the notion and want and put subtle pressure on his wife to be what he wants her to be and not even know he's doing that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. And I think we have to really work at getting beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult. It's something that we get lured into, we get sleepy about. And if that dance is going on, where I, as the wife, am afraid to challenge the possibility that my husband might not like something about me, and the husband doesn't want to challenge his own boundaries, then we have this dance that we unconsciously just are playing out throughout our lives.
So would you go so far as to say that for a husband to love his wife, it's not enough to kind of give her permission to have her own values and her own pursuits and be her own person? It's not enough to say that. He needs to actually positively encourage her, support her, and promote her seeking her own independent identity. I mean, he really needs to be aggressive in making sure that's happening. Would you go so far as to say that?
Yeah, but I think it goes both ways.
Yeah,
I think
yeah, of
we
course.
Both.
Sure.
I think as a wife, I need to be. I think your word aggressive is probably important, because I have to aggressively work against my desire to be selfish.
Right.
I want to take and have you be what I want you to be. So, quite honestly, I don't have to be challenged in the very core of who I am. And that's what happens in marriage at its best: is we're challenging each other in areas that are very difficult for us to face. So yes, I have to aggressively work at encouraging you to be who you are, but in doing that, what's underneath that is I have to aggressively work at being willing to look at who I am.
How would you draw the line between, and I'm thinking about my own marriage, there are probably many things that I do that are not really for me. They're much more important to my wife than they are to me. And oftentimes I don't do them enough and don't do them well enough, but at least I see in me a tendency to want to conform to what's acceptable to my wife. But I don't feel the least bit coerced or manipulated. I take it on voluntarily. I mean, I eagerly accommodate her. And that's part of what we've talked about in past programs, is part of becoming one is to respect the other person enough that I meet them more than halfway. I do accommodate them. I do submit. What's the difference between submitting to the desires and wishes and values of your partner versus losing your identity?
Well, again, we've talked about this before, but I think it's worthy to talk about because it certainly comes up a lot. Let me look at it from a different perspective than we've talked about first, and that's, I think, if we are submitting out of anything but the desire to love the other person, if we're doing it because we feel afraid or out of our laziness, then what we end up with is a very deep bitterness. I say deep bitterness because it goes deep into our souls. We end up being resentful and hard, and people who aren't thankful or gracious or kind or charitable in our marriages. We don't have compassion for, patience for, forgiveness for, trust in our marriage partner or in ourselves. And so what we end up with is not a marriage that has a lot of give and take, a lot of compassion, a lot of forgiveness, but one that's rigid, hurtful, harsh. And maybe that rigidness, that hurtfulness, that harshness doesn't come out for many, many years. But I've worked with lots of women who over time have given up themselves over their fear of not being cared about if they kind of go in their own direction and become a person in their own right. They maybe have never overtly showed their anger, but they are nonetheless, at age 55, very, very angry women. And they feel very much like victims. They have had to go along with their husband all these years, and they're just sick and tired of it. Well, the reality is, it isn't just that they've had to go along with their husbands. The reality is that they haven't had the courage to risk becoming a person that is growing. They have decided to stifle themselves, to not extend, going back to Scott Peck's definition, to not extend themselves courageously to grow up, but have kept very narrow in a very dependent stance toward their spouse.
And so you think the predominant motive that keeps them there is fear?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And so it's incumbent upon the husbands to not allow themselves to stay fearful of them. They need to do whatever they can to create an atmosphere where their wives are not afraid to grow and to develop, even if that means not becoming what the husband wants them to be and not growing in the direction that the husband wants them to grow. For me to love my wife involves my making an aggressive commitment to give my wife the freedom to grow up to be the woman God wants her to be, not the woman I want her to be.
Yeah, and I think that's a really tough thing to do, Jack.
Yeah.
I think we really want to demand that the other person be what I want them to be. And I think we employ all sorts of different things in order to get that person to be that way.
Now, I'm thinking of something I read years ago about Elvis Presley having picked and married, I think it was Priscilla, that's his wife's name, very early on, and tried to mold her into the ideal wife for himself. That's probably an extreme form, but it's probably a temptation that men face all the time, to take the woman that they're marrying and shape her into the status symbol or the catch that gives them some kind of some kind of sense of power and importance or value or something on a whole different level.
Certainly that is a really big temptation for men to do that. I've certainly seen that happen a lot. I'm sure you have seen that happen a lot. Let's get back to that in just a few minutes.
In just a moment, Jack and Christine will continue their discussion on marriage. Now, I'd like to tell you something about Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a great books college. What does that mean? Well, one way to answer the question is to say that the focus of Gutenberg is reading and discussing books written by the greatest thinkers of Western civilization. Another way of answering the question is to describe what a typical day looks like for a Gutenberg student. The day begins by delving into the deep and elegant thought of the ancient Greek mathematicians. In front of his peers, and with their help, a student sorts through a carefully crafted proof penned over 2,000 years ago. Following, the students probe into the nature of written language and the study of classical Greek. It is here that he or she builds the tools for clear writing and skilled reading. Next, they learn of the rise of the Roman Empire. And throughout the week, students will hear lectures on Roman politics, art, religion, and philosophy. They will have the opportunity to ask questions during these lectures, gaining insight into the Roman state. They see how the Romans fit into the bigger picture of developing and declining cultures, which have brought us to where we are today. Then the day culminates with a discussion seminar on Virgil's Aeneid. Together, students seek to understand the story, sometimes exasperated and sometimes excited, but always engaged. After classes, informal discussions are carried on while others chat about the day's event. In the relaxed setting, a student spends a few moments getting to know an instructor. If you're interested in this kind of education, an education that focuses on growing in wisdom, listen at the end of the program for information on how you can contact Gutenberg College. And now, let's return to Jack and Christine's discussion on marriage.
Jack, before this break, we looked at ways that women give up themselves, and we, bottom line, women give up themselves out of fear of what might happen if they don't go along with what their husband wants. Ultimately, I believe that we are afraid of loneliness, that we'll be rejected or abandoned or not liked, and that sense of loneliness that we're all trying to avoid in our lives would come up, we're afraid, if we take on being our own separate and unique people. We also said that it's really important for men to aggressively work at helping the wife become a person that's her own individual self. On the other hand, a man might not want to do that. He might not want to do that out of many reasons, but one is he might want to make her a corsage for himself, where he looks powerful, he looks good, he looks benevolent, he looks like he feels powerful. And ultimately, though, I think at the bottom of that is if he feels those things, then he also gets to avoid a sense of aloneness. He gets to feel like he has value. What we're doing then is instead of being valued ultimately unconditionally, we're being valued or trying to be valued, grasping, digging, scratching toward being valued by changing ourselves or changing the other person. And I don't think that's the kind of value you were talking about at the very beginning of our hour.
Right. And really even the source of the value changes. If my wife is just a status symbol or a corsage, as you put it, I like that, I'm seeking my value in the eyes of other men.
Now, you don't like that women are corsages. You're saying that
no,
you like
just
if
that imagery,
it's a good metaphor.
Yeah, that imagery is very helpful to see what men are capable of doing at times. It's very dehumanizing to the woman. I mean, if all she is a source of status in the eyes of other people, then that's certainly not loving my wife. It's just using her, exploiting her to gain value in the eyes of other people. What I think is the purpose of marriage is not for me to feel value and significance in the eyes of the public out there, but in the eyes of my wife. Somebody who knows me intimately, who lives with me day in and day out. And as you say, that can be unconditional, given the right kind of commitment. Whereas the public is very fickle. And if I'm really a fool to exploit my wife to gain honor and respect and value in the eyes of the public out there, rather than to ignore the opinions and the fickle evaluations of the public and find satisfaction in and find reward in the faithful, loyal commitment of my wife for me, who cares for me and values me and finds me significant. I think that's what we are intended to do. But we're so foolish that we throw that away.
Certainly, though, the big problem for us, and it comes from our sinfulness, is that we want applause on the big stage.
Exactly, yeah.
Applause from one person, applause that only comes in very secret corners of our lives, perhaps only in our home, that's a very difficult thing for us just to live with. We want to promote power, we want to look big, we want to look important to many, many people, and that is an incredible surge in us to want to go toward.
Right.
So I think that's at the bottom of some of what's going on with us, and it has nothing to do with pursuing goodness or loving.
No, quite the contrary. I mean, the more I think about it, the more evil it looks. It's not beyond us as men to want to have a woman that will make other men eat their heart out. I mean, that can be our perspective. I want a good-looking woman or a desirable woman, somebody that when other people say that I see that I'm married to that woman, will go, wow, I wish I could have her. That I don't think we're beyond that. That's how absolutely corrupt and evil our hearts are. And that, of course, is a terrible thing, a terrible perspective to take toward my wife. I mean, let alone the terrible attitude it is toward other people. It's devastating to my relationship with my wife, because she simply becomes a tool now. She's not a human being that I respect for her own individuality. She's something I can use in my power struggle with other people. That's terrible.
In my power struggle with other people, also in my power struggle with myself to become something that is bigger and better than actually I feel myself to be.
Right.
And
right.
Certainly if I'm using my husband or my wife as a corsage, then I think that's very, very indicative of me feeling small. Not only do men want women to be a corsage for what they look like, but what would you say about men often wanting women to be a corsage in the sense that they are submissive in the wrong way? They are puppets that are simply following the man, and the man ends up feeling big because there's somebody who is looking after their every need, following their every word, mimicking them in a way that makes them feel very comfortable.
Yeah, no, I think that's very true. The need for that is tremendous. I've talked to people who've worked in the service industry as waiters and waitresses, and the way they get treated by the public sometimes is incredible. That it's not that they are asked to serve; they are asked to be the slave of these other people, and apparently for no other reason than to feed that kind of sense of, I'm important enough, I'm big enough, I'm powerful enough that other people will wait on me, other people will do my bidding. And I say that just to illustrate how insatiable that desire is in some people to have other people serve them in order to meet some kind of emotional need that they think needs to be met. Well, that can be transferred over into marriage, that my wife can be my slave, can be my servant. I'm important enough to have a servant, and here's mine. I think that's true.
Jack, what comes to mind to me is a question that a lot of people may have that are listening today. They might be saying, what about taking up our cross? What about losing ourselves for Jesus' sake?
Well, yeah, for example, Luke chapter 14, he says, whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. And I suppose that's what you're referring to. Jesus is not talking about marriage when he says that. I mean, not directly about marriage, or not specifically about marriage. What he's talking about is there are several things that we need to do in life. We need to recognize the nature of my own evil and my own sinfulness, recognize that the death that Jesus died on the cross is a death that I deserve to die. That's how hideous my evil is, my selfishness, my greed, my moral brokenness is that hideous that it really deserves the death that Jesus died. We also need to not try to prop up and keep alive the me that has such short-sighted, foolish value, worldly values that it comes so naturally to me. I need to put that person to death. I need to leave it in the grave, leave it behind, and be a person who learns a whole different set of values and so on.
For example, I need to leave behind, perhaps, in my marriage, the desire to be powerful through having a wife that just mimics me.
Exactly.
I need to give up having her be a corsage. As a wife, I might need to give up or die to my fears.
Exactly. Exactly. And so the application of marriage is just as you say, that there are these very very worldly values that come so naturally to us that are going to lead me to exploit the other person rather than commit myself to loving them in the way that you've been describing. And so what Jesus is saying is, I need to be prepared to say no to that person, a big, huge, capital letter N, no to that person who so naturally goes in the direction of exploiting the other person, and who instead sees the value and the reward of being a person who loves my spouse. That's
so
what it means to die to myself.
I need to say no to me.
Yeah, to the sinful me that comes so naturally. I need to say no to me, yeah. But that's not to say no to the individual creature that God has created me to be. I don't need to say no to that. In fact, I need to say yes to that. To say no to that, if we say no to that through self-hatred and self-contempt and self-rejection, that's really another worldly rebellious response. I'm basically saying to God, you know, what you made me to be is not acceptable to me. It's not adequate. You didn't make me what I want to be. Well, God didn't ask me what I want to be. He made me to be what He wanted me to be. And part of my obedience to Him is, and part of my saying yes to God, is to accept that and to be who I am on God's terms.
So you're saying it really is an act of rebellion to say to not like who I am, to not be a person who is willing to accept the person that God made me.
Yeah, ultimately that is.
Would we also say that it's an act of rebellion to not have the courage to say no to the part of us that is very sinful?
Right, right.
It takes a lot of wisdom here, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. But it is helpful to see that we are never called upon to say no to the creature God made me to be. We're only being called upon to say no to the sinner that I am and the values that are entailed by that. That I need to repudiate. That I need to reject. I need to put that to death. But then I need to, once I've repudiated my sinfulness, then I need to embrace and take delight in the creature that God made me to be and to grow in that and become a righteous person in the unique sort of way that God created me as an individual.
And getting back to marriage, that's exactly what I need to do as a marriage partner. I need to help my spouse do those things, to help them look at their sin, but even more so, encourage them in the creature that God made them to be, to value them such that they're understanding and appreciating who God made them to be.
Right.
And they're becoming bigger. I'm extending myself to help them extend themselves.
And I suppose this gets really, you said it takes wisdom. I think this gets really tricky because I don't suppose I really have the power to grow my wife up. I mean, I don't have the power to jump inside of her heart and jump inside of her mind and make her make those decisions to not be fearful and so on. I can only create an environment for her to make that choice. And so I think it's important to see that as well.
I really want to jump on that, and I just love the way that you said that, because we try so hard to make another person the way we want them to be, even the good way that we want them to be.
Uh-huh.
And we need to have as our goal love and drop our intention of making the other person be that way.
That's good.
I can only love them and let whatever happens happen. That's between them and God. My responsibility is to be a lover and to do that in the very best way I know how.
Yeah, that's good.
I'd like to talk some more about the specifics of how we can love each other. And I think one of the biggest ones that I've experienced in my relationship with my husband is his willingness to extend himself to tell me the truth. Telling me the truth often includes telling me things that I don't like to hear about myself. in order for a person to have the right, though, to tell the truth, to tell me the truth and have insight into what, quote, the truth might be, I need to be humble enough to think that maybe I'm not right. I need to put out the information to the other person, but be willing humbly to be wrong. One of the ways, though, that I might be closer to being able to tell the truth to my spouse is a willingness to really open myself up to attentively listen to who they are. Not to who I want them to be, not to who even they think they might be, but to listen with my ears, with my eyes, with watch their actions, watch everything, so that I'm not just looking through my own spectacles, my own different colored spectacles, but I'm really trying to look at and understand and see them. I think it's only under those conditions that I really can be in a place to tell another person the truth. I think also in telling another person the truth, I have to be willing to experience conflict, because more often than not, when I tell someone the truth, they're not going to want to hear it, because I'm telling them about a part of them that is very difficult to see. Ultimately, perhaps our biggest downfall is we don't want to see the sinfulness in ourselves. That's what we're most blind to, and of course that's what we most need to see. So if I'm looking after my own comfort, I probably will never be a person that's telling myself, my husband, the truth, or he telling me the truth.
So the desire to avoid conflict is oftentimes the reason why we don't take the step of telling the truth to one another. It's just not worth it. It's just too big of a hassle, and so they want me to lie to him. Okay, I'll lie to him just to keep the peace.
Right.
That's what you're saying.
And that, again, is not extending myself
exactly.
at all.
Exactly. I was going to say, that's what you meant earlier by extending myself, is to decide this is not about me being in a relationship that's always convenient. This is about me doing what's in their best interest ultimately. If they're going to grow up, if they're going to develop as a person, one of the things I need to do for them is tell them the truth. And I'm going to catch fury in certain situations when I do that. But that's what I need to do for them, is to make them squirm until they get over their reaction. And in the context of the love that I've listened to them, I've respected them, I'm not going to abandon them, I'm not going to forsake them, I'm just telling it like I see it. Unless they're completely unreasonable and irrational, eventually they'll settle down and let me tell them the truth, even if the initial reaction is not fun.
Well, if they're rational, they may. It may take many, many years to be willing to hear it. I think in a new marriage, I think being able to tell the truth is more difficult than it is later on. But I don't think one of the things you said kind of scared me. I need to keep telling them even though they squirm and keep pushing it. And I think if they squirm, perhaps I need to drop it.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And come back to it. I don't drop my understanding or my awareness, and it might keep evolving into something that's much more wise. But initially, I certainly need to be making a lot of efforts in that direction.
Yeah, you mentioned that what we react to is we don't like to hear the message that we are sinful. I think it goes beyond that too. We don't like to hear the message that we have limitations. Maybe it's just us men that have that problem. But I can remember early on having a very, very difficult time. I'm in an occupation where I write papers occasionally, and starting off, I'm not even a good writer to this day, but I was a not at all good writer when I first got married. My wife is a very good writer. And I would take my stuff to her and, you know, ask for her critique. And her critique was not exactly positive. You know, she would tell me the truth. Well, your writing is inadequate in this respect, in this respect, in this respect. And I had a horrible time hearing that.
You didn't want to hear that you were limited.
I didn't want to hear that I had any flaws or any weaknesses or any limitations on my being at all. I wanted to be a good everything, including a good writer, even though it wasn't the truth. And what I really wanted for her to do, for what I really wanted from her, is for her to lie to me, tell me that this is great. And to her credit, she didn't do that. But I made it hard for her. I really made it hard for her to tell me the truth.
So what we're talking about is Jody being willing to extend herself courageously, and that's a huge part of love, rather than avoid the conflict, the abandonment, and ultimately the aloneness. She said no to her fear and went on and talked to you about what was true. And it's something that you needed to learn. You needed to extend yourself in the direction, apparently, of learning that you are a limited individual. And that's a place that you needed to, could I say, grow up.
Right, exactly, absolutely. And I can imagine myself in that situation to have completely shut Jody down. I mean, as it is, she needed to back off and watch her timing and that kind of thing. But if I had not had basically, ultimately, deep down, enough humility to finally hear her, I probably could have shut her down and she'd be lying to me and flattering me to this day.
You could have exerted enough control, enough power in many, many different ways to get her to shut up.
Yeah, exactly.
And the ultimate end of that would have been, Jack, that you would be a smaller person.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have been maturing. You wouldn't have been wiser. You wouldn't have known more. And in your marriage, it would have been smaller.
Yes, absolutely.
It would have been so much less. It would have been saying to Jody, really, that what you have to say to me isn't important to me. I'm not really valuing your input in my life. So we're coming back to this valuing thing. It's easy to say I value you. It's hard. It's so hard to live it out. This weekend, I was at a conference at a conference center. I have to get 20 hours of continuing education each year to continue my license. And it's very difficult to find education that I find very helpful, being a Christian and being in the psychological world. It's very, very difficult. One of the exercises that they wanted us to do in this seminar is there was a woman that was really hurting, and they brought her down into the middle of the room, and they told everybody to stand up and look at her and love her with unconditional love in her eyes. Well, it's very easy for me to sit there and love somebody ostensibly, is that the way to say it?
Mm-hmm.
Unconditionally. But the reality is, if there's no risk in love, if there's no exchange in love, then it's easy for me to quote unconditionally love. It's so much more difficult when there is risk involved. I often don't want to take the risk. I admire Jody that she took the risk with you. It would be an extension of herself in a very big way to continue in a loving way to say, Jack, this is a limit of yours, and for you to finally give in to that.
And the reward is a deep and profound connection between the two of us, where we have a mutual respect. Respect is even too weak of a word. We value one another much more deeply. And so several years down the line, we have a very rewarding relationship that I would not have had I shut her down.
You have a relationship that's the opposite of being invisible or unimportant.
Yeah.
You have a relationship where you not just feel valued out of your own sense of need to be valued, but you truly are being valued in a very practical and wise way by your wife.
Exactly.
Stay tuned. In just a moment, Jack and Christine will conclude today's discussion on marriage. Over the years, a lot of people have come through Mackenzie Study Center. Some have come to study biblical interpretation. Some come to focus on applying the truth of the Bible to the world we live in. And others come for the great Bible teaching. And still others come because they need a place to think about their faith. What is Mackenzie? It's a group of people who take the Bible seriously, who see the goal of this life as the pursuit of righteousness and wisdom, who see the gospel as the most profound message in all of human history. The Mackenzie staff members have dedicated their lives to the pursuit of knowing the truth contained in the Bible. They see the need to get back to the Bible as more important than ever in this darkening world. Getting back to the Bible means trying to understand what the biblical authors intended to say when they wrote the Bible. And this can be hard work. The scriptures are often difficult to interpret and understand. Sometimes the Bible doesn't always say what we want it to say. But if we are to come to understand this world and our place in it from God's perspective, then the hard work of biblical interpretation is worth it. This is the passion motivating the staff and families of Mackenzie Study Center. If you are interested in knowing more about Mackenzie, we'll give you information on how to contact us at the end of the program. And when you do, you might ask for some of our News and Views articles, such as Forgiveness, The Parable of the Unforgiving Servant by Ron Julian. In this article, Ron takes a close look at Christ's statement that if we don't forgive, we will not be forgiven. Ron's conclusion is that Christ meant exactly what he said. God's people know that they are sinners, and only the mercy of God stands between them and their deserved destruction. It is this humility, without which no one can come to the cross of Christ, which results in forgiving others. Ron argues that Jesus makes this point most forcefully in the parable of the unforgiving servant. Again, at the end of the program, we'll give you information on how you can find out more about McKenzie Study Center. Now, here are Jack and Christine as they conclude today's discussion on marriage.
My husband's going to be leaving on a business trip for 10 days. Here in about 3 or 4 days, he's leaving. And I'm really sad that he's going, because Larry is a person who, above anyone else in the world, helps me have a sense of myself as a person who's valued and loved and important. I like having him around. He's a very, very big part of what is very, very good in my life. That's true because Larry has extended himself to love me. He has extended himself to look at my best interest rather than to only pursue his. He's been a person who's willing to let me be a separate individual in my own right. He's encouraged that tremendously in our marriage by not making me a corsage, as we said earlier, so that he gets beautified by my presence. But he's tried to make me beautiful. He's trying to encourage my growth in so many different ways. One of the ways that he's done that is to tell me the truth, even when it's difficult for him, even when it might and certainly does in our relationship create conflict. He's stuck to it. He's loved me in spite of it, even when I respond inappropriately.
The irony in our life is that what we want is to be happy. And in our foolishness and our short-sightedness, we seek to be happy by using my partner, by using my wife, or by using my husband in one way or the other to exploit them to bring me happiness. And here's the irony. It seems to me that the only way marriage can be rewarding in the way God intended it to be rewarding is when I don't look to be happy through my wife or husband, but rather I seek, as you say, to extend myself to promote their growth, to give them the freedom to become the person that God wanted them to be. It's by giving myself that I find myself. I think that's true of life in general, but it's certainly true in marriage. My psyche is going to find the thing that I want and find real joy and delight in my relationship. If I don't look for joy in my relationship, I look to serve the other person. Then and only then is it going to be rewarding.
And doesn't that really bring to life what Jesus said? Out of death comes life.
Yeah.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, the radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you enjoy surfing the net, look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write that down, the information will be repeated in just a moment. The staff of McKenzie Study Center is dedicated to pursuing wisdom, growing in love, and understanding God's Word. And they invite you to join with them through listening to the program, attending any of the classes or seminars, or reading their articles and papers. However, the staff of McKenzie also believes that their teaching and dialogue stand in deep need of God's mercy. They trust God that their ministry will be valuable to others. The McKenzie Study Center is also a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. Again, if you would like to know more about the McKenzie Study Center, its tapes, articles, or you would like a copy of this program, please call us at area code 541-485-4801. Again, 541-485-4801. or write to us at Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. Now, on behalf of the staff and community of the Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.